This episode, I'm joined once again by John Michael Greer to discuss the Kabbalah. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, John Michael Greer, thanks once again for joining me on Hermetics Podcast.
Well, thank you again for having me on.
We are going to be broadly discussing the Kabbalah and the Tree of Life and the Sephiroth and the paths and the symbolism here that is at the core of a lot of Western esoteric discussions. It is perhaps one of the primary grammars, we could say, of modern Western esotericism.
I would certainly agree with that.
So, as is usually the case, there's a couple of huge questions, one following after the other. But as, as I like to do now, I will just ask you the open question. How would you explain what the Kabbalah is?
That would depend very much on who I was talking to. If I was talking to somebody who had some exposure to esoteric spirituality of some sort, I would say it's a way of talking about different states of consciousness, relating them to one another. It's a map of the inner world. If I were talking to someone who didn't have that kind of exposure, I probably wouldn't mention it at all. Because people, you know, on the one hand, of course, you have, there's a lot of weirdness out there. And a lot of people who are very quick to misunderstand anything that doesn't fit into their experience. And so, the Kabbalah is a map of the inner worlds. It is a map of states of consciousness. Of course, it is a map. It is not the territory. It is a schematization of the way that of certain states that human beings can either enter into or brush up against. And it's extremely useful for that reason. On the other hand, it has been horribly misused in various ways. It has been misinterpreted. It has been turned into a straitjacket. It, of course, is like almost everything else imaginable, is in the middle of various woke controversies and attempts to accuse this or that group of cultural appropriation. And so, as with so much, you know, it really does depend on the audience.
So, before I get into the other question, actually, this is a huge question. So, I mean, we can sort of paint this with broad strokes. But where does it originate and how does it evolve? Because I guess with regard to the discussion that we're having and the discussions that we've had in the past, you know, there is this strange thing of when we mention the Kabbalah now, I mean, perhaps it would be more productive to say, well, you know, modern Western Kabbalah. Right? Like, that's often what we're talking about, because it does change, and the,
of course,
you know, the history is broad here.
The history is very broad, and the history is in fact broader than most people like to talk about. One of the things that makes in particular some of those cultural appropriation conversations very loaded right now is that the Kabbalah was not originally Jewish. If you look into some of the classic histories of the origins of the Kabbalah. I'm forgetting Gershom Scholem's The Origin of the Kabbalah. That's the one I'm trying to think of. He traces it quite accurately to Gnostic traditions, and that's not a speculative thing. It appears in Gnostic writings centuries before its first appearance in Judaism. You have the there's a version of the Tree of Life that is included in the Christian writer Origen's book Contra Celsum, Against Celsus. And Celsus, who was writing about a century earlier, gives a version of the Tree of Life as something that these bizarre Christian Gnostics are into. And whereas Origen is saying, no, that's those people. That's not us. But everyone, obviously, both parties in the debate and their readers were familiar with this thing. If you trace it back all the way, it's pretty clearly a product of the Pythagorean movement in ancient Greek philosophy. And this is why so many of the core words in Kabbalist use, Sephiroth. Sephiroth doesn't, I mean, you can winkle it around to kind of mean something in Hebrew, but Sephiroth is very clearly a Hebrew pronunciation of Greek sphera, sphere. Similarly, gematria doesn't mean anything in Hebrew, but it's geometria, or possibly grammatea, either geometry or has, you know, the science of writing in Greek. Equally, the great archangel Metatron. That's not a Hebrew word either. It's Metathronos, before the throne in Greek. There's basically, so what we have here is a Pythagorean and Middle Platonic tradition that was picked up by the Gnostics, that went from the Gnostics to various sources, that came along with a lot of Gnostic materials to southern France in the 11th century, which is when the historic Kabbalah came into being. It was picked up by Jewish mystics at that time, and sensibly so. It worked very well with their tradition, and reworked for within the needs of rabbinic Judaism. And then, within a couple of centuries, it passed from there to Christian Kabbalists, mm-hmm. and who proceeded to modify it further, and who also drew very heavily on the Pythagorean and Platonic elements, of course, that they had access to during the Renaissance. And then away we go. And eventually, by the time we get to Eliphas Levi, we get to the Golden Dawn, we get to Dion Fortune, and so on. And they're dealing with sort of distilled essence of the Western tradition that has drawn on almost every significant source within that fed into Western occultism. It's hard to name anything that didn't become a part of it at one point or another.
Mm. Let's just stick with the Pythagorean for a little bit, because it made me think of one of your books, Learning Ritual Magic. And how to draw the Tree of Life. I'll get to the Tree of Life in a minute, but one of the interesting things that's pointed out in that book is, if I can remember this right, people get ready to visualize, draw five circles, I believe it is. Five circles.
Four, sir. Four, it's actually three and a half. It's a total of three and a half circles. But
three and a half circles, kind of... and then where they, if you can imagine, then drawing circles at the halfway point of those circles, half and half again on either side, which is then three. And these, this geometrical, we could say geometrical balance or harmony evolves into the shape that becomes the Tree of Life. So what is this geometric foundation? I mean, what is that?
Okay. We're going to have to get into a little bit of sacred geometry here. Mm-hmm. One of the basic patterns in traditional sacred geometry makes use of the square root of three. If you take take a circle and you draw another circle with its center on the circumference of the first circle and the same diameter as the original circle, okay? Mm-hmm. So each one has its center on the other circumference. There's a space between them, a kind of sort of a pointed oval. The vesica piscis is what it's called. It shows up all through mystical art and this kind of stuff. But the vesica, if the distance between the width of the short side is one, the length of the long side is the square root of three. And the geometry that unfolds from those nested circles is square root of three geometry, and that's the geometry of the Tree of Life. Now, the interesting thing, of course, nowadays we have an entire school of sacred geometry basically marketed by a guy named who goes by Drunvalo Melchizedek, which has this thing called the Flower of Life, which is just an extended set of vesica, of overlapping circles producing vesicas. And so a lot of people nowadays actually know a little bit about that. But the Tree of Life is a much simpler version of that. You simply run a series of circles, each one taking its center on the circumference of the other, all of them the same diameter, all of them aligned along a straight line down the center, and bip, 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 the entire Tree of Life falls into place. So, you know, that's one of many indications that shows the kind of Pythagorean substructure of the Kabbalistic system.
So with this, there's so much here. It's like the most interconnected grammar imaginable. But we can just stay with the Tree of Life for a little bit. So from this sacred geometry, this somehow evolves into the shape that most people will know when they think of the Kabbalah. The sort of the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah in terms have sort of become synonymous. And perhaps there's something else we could talk about, is what is out, you know, what else is there other than the Tree of Life? But we have this.
We have the Tree of Life. We have this geometrical diagram that explains that explains the world. This geometric diagram that maps the inner states of human consciousness, and we have 10 spheres Sephiroth. We have generally 22 lines. It did vary. There's a lot of there's a lot of variation. If you look through the historical through the history of the Kabbalah, you find there are all kinds of variations, and that's appropriate. You know, people are taking this and saying, okay, I'm going to tweak it here and there to fit my experiences of the inner world. And so, but broadly speaking, you've got the 10 spheres, you've got 22 paths, and the lowest sphere is material existence as we experience with it with our ordinary five senses. And everything else unfolds above and within that, and opens up into different modes of spiritual experience that are accessible to human beings.
There's a couple of other additions that we can get to. You know, I'm sure as you well know, when we get to the crown, when we get to Kether. But well, beyond that, there's of course a few more additions. But one, you know. As you know, I like abstract questions, even though it evolves for various other Kabbalistic practices, this shape. We do have this sort of central shape, which is, the 10 spheres, or maybe 11 if you're including Darth. But why this shape?
To some extent, because it fits the geometry. To some extent, why not? It could be almost any shape. If you look at especially some of the early modern Jewish Kabbalistic writings, they actually use many different shapes. Mm-hmm. I've seen some that arrange them around a circle, mostly, where you have Tifereth in the center, you have everything else arranged around a circle. Actually, Tifereth in the center, and Yesod between the center and the bottom, and everything else is just around a circle. So there are different shapes you can use. It's just, this one has proven to be convenient in practice.
Okay. So here's the other big question. So this is, it's something that just absolutely fascinates me. And I think your position as a druid, I think, is sort of the strange in between here.
Yes.
So after a recent conversation about the work of Kenneth Grant, which I know you're familiar with, Kenneth Grant goes, does often a sort of classic esoteric tactic, right? We need to go back, we need to go right back, and goes back to the Setian tradition, which is then away from what is now sort of roughly known as the solar phallic, you could say the upwards, up-down, vertical tradition. And Grant then plays on the more immanent tradition, which is let's say more rooted. So, and then when we move through to the modern Western esoteric tradition, in many of its, in I would say the majority of its varieties, we have held on to this notion of verticality as above, so below, and also I think why this is a good place to bring it in is because the Tree of Life, as probably the central grammar, I would argue, of Western esotericism, is an emphatic representation of this idea of we are going upwards. The great chain of being, the ladder of divine ascent, we go up. So why do we love going up spiritual ladders and not just keeping our feet on the ground? And this is why I think, as I say with the druidry thing, there's a bit of both.
There is. It's interesting because very broadly speaking, in Western esoteric practice, there are three basic approaches. You have what we can call the solar path, which works on this descending power from above and the ascent of the soul. You have what we could call the telluric path, which works with power that ascends from the earth and descending into those telluric energies. And you have what, in the particular tradition that I was taught, is referred to as the lunar path, which uses both forces, which calls both the solar and the telluric and holds them into balance. Druidry is not a... Druidry has this thing about not doing dogma. Ask three druids, you'll get at least five answers. And there are druid traditions that are solar, there are druid traditions that are telluric, but the one that I studied and a fairly wide range of others focus on that lunar path, that capacity to work with both powers and to balance both powers. So it really is a matter of I don't know, what would you say? There's a cultural idiom more than anything else. Interestingly, if you look at some of the earlier pre-Kabbalistic Jewish systems of mysticism, the Merkabah tradition of mysticism, for example, they all talk about going down to the Merkabah. You don't arise to it. You descend into it. So it can go that way, too. And since, you know, we're not talking about moving in any direction. These states of consciousness we're talking about are not stacked like plates. They're all here all the time. Paul Foster Case, who was, of course, a crackerjack Kabbalist, you know, all the power that ever was or will be is here now. And so it's purely a matter of how do you represent it in a society that tends to think, to have that upward metaphor. It's easy to see them stacked in a vertical direction. You could as well, you know, run it downwards or run it off to one side or have it as nested circles or what have you.
Okay. I think what's a crackerjack Kabbalist?
A crackerjack means really good in American.
Okay.
Yeah, when you refer to a crackerjack Kabbalist, crackerjack what have you, you're saying somebody who's really hot.
Okay.
Really good at it. So sorry, my Americanisms are seeping up. But I've sometimes thought that it would have been useful if the Western tradition had absorbed from East Asia the idea of the mandala. So you're working with a nested structure rather than this kind of vertical or what have you. So, yeah.
So I think maybe that, yeah, you've pulled something out there that I think I was probably trying to get to. When we move, especially in Western thought, with our many of the conversations we've had around progress, and especially around the idea of the modern comfort of a hard stop. When I get to this point, I will be enlightened. I will be done. And even though, as you said, these aren't stacked, they are potential states of all the time. The notion of at some point I will get up to the crown and be, you know, and be done. This vocality does give us a sort of visual representation of I just need to level up. Or, you know, we see this a lot in lodges and the way Western
if I can simply get that furthest degree. One of the things I appreciate about the specific version of Kabbalah that I learned from my teacher John Gilbert is that he stresses you can't get to the top three spheres. You know, the top three spheres are states of being that the human consciousness cannot attain to. We can brush up against them. We can interact with their effects, but they're permanently beyond us. So, you know, live with it.
Well, before we start climbing the tree, there's a couple of other one other thing I want to tackle. A lot of different spellings of the Kabbalah. I don't think I've ever seen a word spelled so many different ways. Why is this?
It's the standard mismatch between Indo-European languages and Semitic languages. It happens all the time. Do you recall the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi? People spelled his name in like 11 different ways because Arabic and Hebrew are closely related, and they use sounds that don't represent well in any Indo-European language. That initial consonant in both Gaddafi's name and the Kabbalah, it's the same consonant. It's not a consonant we have in English. It's kind of a k and kind of a k, and, you know, what is it? We don't have it. And the vowels are not the same, and it's a mess. So everyone's trying to come up with something that more or less sounds the same, and it doesn't.
But am I right in thinking that there have been a few sort of what we might call linguistic habits that have formed around the spellings, especially once it is transliterated into English? I mean, we see this with Dion Fortune, right? She would often, or some people would often use C-A-B-A-L-A as a Christian Kabbalah, but this is all, you know, just ways of ease, really.
Exactly. It's convenient. It has been fairly common for Jewish writers to use K-A-B-B-A-L-A-H for the Jewish Kabbalah, and Fortune et al. Like to use as near as an exact transcription as they can, Q-A-B-A-L-I-H. And then the oldest version in English and in Latin also is C-A-B-A-L-A.
Mm.
Okay. That was the one when the first Latin writings about the Kabbalah back in the Renaissance used that, and the first English writings about the Kabbalah in the Elizabethan period used that. That's the one that I've used.
Mm-hmm.
And I've literally had to put a little foreword at the beginning of each of my books that has referenced the Kabbalah, saying, "Oh, by the way, this is why I'm using it. It's purely because it's, you know, it's the it." Until the recent squabbles began, it was the standard spelling, and it's a perfectly sensible English word. It's been around for around longer than a lot of words we use today,
mm-hmm.
and so we might as well.
Okay. Well, if you're up for it, let's briefly in the time that we have, begin an ascent of this tree. Mm-hmm. But by beginning an ascent, I want to actually, you know, beginning at the bottom with Malkuth, mm-hmm. kingdom,
mm-hmm.
Where we are, the mm-hmm. world, I guess. I actually want to draw in another book because it's this key oversight, I think, of a lot of spiritual paths. And the other book is mm-hmm. St. Teresa of Avila's The Interior Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And what intrigues me about this book is, you know, this whole thing of we need to get into the castle, which is the mansions of God, and then we'll go through all these different rooms, these seven rooms, and eventually we'll get closer and closer to God. But mm-hmm. what intrigues me about it, and also this intrigues me about many of the writings I've read about the Kabbalah, is the lack of emphasis of how to get even into the castle. So say, oh, there's all these demons and base desires and things that are going to pull you away from your spiritual journey outside, but don't worry, you'll get over that and you'll get into the castle and then mm-hmm. you can start your journey. And I think the emphasis of, hang on, why are so many people stuck or not even mm-hmm. moving on mm-hmm. Malkuth? You know, what's happening here?
Well, now, this is something St. Teresa would disagree, doubtless, because, you know, she's coming from a different tradition. But from within the occult tradition, you have to remember that at any given time, half of humanity is still completing the descent into matter. Mm. And their job is to focus on the material. Dion Fortune used to use the metaphor of a yacht race, where you have to go around this buoy that's way out there before you can come back. You know, you sail out that way and you sail back. And you actually have to go all the way out and round the buoy. And if you don't, you're disqualified and you have to go back and do it again. So she's basically saying, for at any given time, half the human race is busy finishing its descent into matter, learning its way around the material world. So it's not even that they're stuck, it's that they're doing their job. They're doing what they're supposed to do and focusing on figuring out how to be material beings in material bodies. Then you actually get all the way to the nadir, all the way to that point where you are as far into matter as you will go. At that point, you know, you slip around the buoy, and then everything's different, and then all of a sudden you're going back the other direction. And so one of the things that I think is very important to remember, there's a real tendency for the spiritually minded to think that everybody ought to be up to their eyeballs in spirituality. Everybody ought to be, you know, mystically meditating all the time. And that just ain't so. You know, most people, I mean, half of humanity is their job is to get deeper into matter, to really grapple with, you know, with being human beings, being material beings. And of those who've gone around the buoy and are starting up, many of them are in the very early stages of that. And for them, something like ordinary religion is just fine. They need to learn to orient toward the divine. They need to learn to think. And that's not a fast process. It's not a process to rush. So it really is for a minority of us who, you know, we've rounded the buoy, we've picked up some speed on the way back, and now it's a matter of navigating through this complex channel, or this series of 22 complex channels. And so, you know, once there's the path of creation and then the path of redemption, the path of emanation and then the path of return. And so once you're on the path of return, you're going to make a beeline for it. I mean, many people have experienced that. You know, just they can't not engage in this kind of stuff. And, you know, or you can try to shove it away, but it always comes creeping back. And I think those were the people that St. Teresa was talking to. Those are the people that she's saying, you know, don't worry about it. Just, you know, keep on resisting the demons and the base desires and this kind of stuff, and you will find yourself, you know, if you maintain, you know, what were in her days the ordinary practices of a devout, like, Catholic person, you'll start getting, you're finding yourself into that first room.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, and then, and that's when the guide room, that's when St. Teresa comes along with a tour guide and say, and in this first room, we see, you know.
That's where we get going. Now, if we were to draw that into the Tree of Life, that's where, not immediately, immediately with, you know, we're moving from 10 to 9 to Yezod, which is the foundation. And here we're still, as you were mentioning earlier, with the solar and the lunar together with the balance. Mm-hmm. Here we're still balanced. Here we're still in that. So, you know, we should say the other structure, you know, that the Tree of Life is like, what, like 10 different structures all layered onto each other.
Mm-hmm.
The other structure we haven't mentioned is like the three. So if you were to look at it face on, because then this is where it gets complicated, if we were to then, well, not complicated, but this is where you need to remember if you then mention the Tree of Life in relation to the body, because you turn into it, right?
But I was going to walk carefully back from that for the time being, because we don't have a week of time.
No. We'll leave the microcosm of the Tree of Life alone.
Exactly.
Severity on one side, and then mercy on the other.
You have the two pillars on the side and the one pillar in the center. Yeah. You also, there's all kinds of internal structures. You've got the different triangles, the different triads, and you have the, you know, the different worlds, and it can get very complicated. But I think it's important to start just with a sense of those 10 spheres. You have Malkut, you have the sphere of manifestation, as I was taught to call it, and the world that is just what it appears to be, the world of the five senses. And then you begin to notice that there are, well, I'll kind of wallow in the terminology of my generation from back in the day and say, you start noticing that there are vibes.
The vibes you start are coming noticing, back, you know, that word's I coming know. Back.
Yeah, but you know, there's kind of a feeling. There's kind of these it's almost a sense of like pressure or suction. Stuff's happening that's not quite material. Some stuff's happening that seems to be tied into being alive, into the experience of life. And as you attend to that, you drift insensibly up into Yesod, because Yesod is the center of the life force. Yesod is the foundation. Yesod is the sphere of life. And life, that's where it becomes clear that life is not just a chemical reaction, that it is a force in its own right that expresses itself through chemical reactions. And so you begin getting a sense of that reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people, that's as far as they get. That's the force, you know. The false will be with you always. That's your Yesod initiation. And if that's as far as you get in a lifetime, that's fine. Okay, it's, you know, you've gotten the sense that there's something else. There's this other world of being. There's this realm that structures and shapes the material world, a realm of living power. Okay, now so you've gotten there, and then you start noticing if you're reflecting on, for example, your thinking. You're reflecting on how you think and how your mind works. You've been noticing there are patterns in the life force that seem to be reflected in your mind. The thoughts are actually not just, you know, a sort of secretion from the brain, that they're things. But they have their own influence, their own power. And that's how you gradually drift up to Hod. Now, at this point, you're going over to the side of severity, or the side of form, because these are very formed things. These are structures. And philosophers can get there sometimes, because now we've talked Malkut to Yesod up to the middle pillar and then over to Hod. But you can also go straight from Malkut to Hod. There's a path that goes that way, and that's the way of philosophy. That's the way in Hinduism, Vijnana Yoga, where you become aware of these thoughts, these structures. The universe becomes a thought, a great thought that's thinking itself. And you become aware of thought as an independent power, as something that is not just something that happens in these lumps of greasy jello that we call human brains. So, okay, you've gotten to that. Great. That's when you start realizing that the emotions have an equal reality. And that's a rough one. You know, a lot of people who are really comfortable in their thoughts are not really comfortable with their emotions. Equally, there are people who go straight up to the realm of emotions, and then they have to integrate their thoughts. So the path that connects those two tends to be rough going for a lot of people. But so that gives us Netza. Now those four are these states of awareness, the things that human beings ordinarily can experience without going through any particular transformative spiritual experience. They just have to pay attention to the world, you know, as they encounter it. And in fact, in most societies, not in the modern West, but in most human societies, in most of history, those four things have been treated as four, independent although interconnected realities. It's just we're unusually stupid in the Western world when it comes to our own inner lives, so we just think of it all in immaterial terms. We'll get over it in a few more centuries.
So after this, things start to get interesting. They also, and also in terms of the what we could call the understanding and appropriation of the Tree of Life. This is, whereas I understand it, the first sephira, the first sphere, where there is this sort of key alteration. So to draw on one of the, you know, I know someone, Dion Fortune, you're very fond of her work, but for her, Tiphereth is, if I'm remembering this right, it is equated with Jesus Christ. But if we were to look at Thelema, if I'm also remembering this right, it's Ivas, right? And I imagine
it's been so long since I've read Crowley, I couldn't tell you where the Thelemite pantheon fits on there. But yeah, that would make sense because yeah, that's the point where you come into contact with things that are outside the reach of ordinary human consciousness. You actually have to pass through a certain barrier, symbolically the veil of the sanctuary. And the relation between that and Jesus is actually fairly subtle, because on the one hand, Tiphereth, the sixth sphere, is halfway between the crown and the kingdom. It's halfway between number one and number ten. And so it would be the point if you have, you know, Jesus as man and God. But also there is a sense in a lot of Christian tradition that Jesus is what we all could eventually become. He is the first God-man. He is the, you know, greater things than these shall ye do, he says. And so, yeah, so he's kind of the forerunner. The one who shows us what we should have been doing, what we should be all along. And so, yeah, so he's that representative of that next step above ordinary humanity. And, you know, getting there is not an easy operation. But once you pass through that veil, once you attain that state of inner experience that allows you, you know, the thing that the Eastern traditions call enlightenment, then you add that sphere on top of the four ordinary things. The four becomes five. And all of a sudden you've got that central solar sphere. You become aware that, you know, that your material life is not the only life there is. You become aware that all of these four aspects of yourself that you've learned to operate with are dependent on something much higher. Something much higher, you know, or deeper or greater or what have you. And so that's Tiphereth.
What's Tiphereth for you?
I always end up having to go back to Lao Tzu here. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. Such experiences I have had that I would consider, you know, mystical or you know, having to do with enlightenment, the major factor, the major thing they have all have in common is that trying to express them in words is just almost humiliating. I work with words. I think in words. I make my living from words. And then you run across experiences that, I mean, most experience ultimately are, it's a hell of a job putting them into language. You know, if you've been through the experience of falling in love, if you've been through the experience of witnessing birth or death, if you've been through any really powerful experience, words are just left sort of floundering. And then there are the transcendent experiences. And so all we can do is hint at them. Mm. It's like the old Zen thing about the finger pointing to the moon. You know, you point with a finger, you show the moon. But people tend to focus on the finger and forget that it's meant to direct their attention to something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So words are the finger. Words are the finger, and so often words give us the finger, which the Zennies did not say. But, okay. And so when we're talking about Tiferet, we're talking about something that can't really be clearly expressed in human terms. We can express it in symbols. And so we have the solar symbolism, we have the symbolism of the God-man, of the Redeemer, of the messenger from beyond, if you want Iwas. You know, you have the king and the child and the king and the crucified God and Dion Fortune's sister, what have you. There are two further spheres beyond that, one in the direction of form, one in the direction of force or severity and mercy, if you want to call them, and that's Gibor and Chesed. And like Tiferet, they are very difficult to describe in human terms. I think it was a very important tactical mistake in the Golden Dawn to try to give people initiations corresponding to any of these higher Sephiroth, because you can't communicate that by putting somebody through a ritual, and people would go, "Well, I've received the Adeptus Exemptus degree, so I inhabit the realm of Chesed." No, you don't. You inhabit your own backside. one of them has again the sense of severity, the sense of law, the sense of will. And it is very much a matter of the higher will and not the lower will.
Mm.
And the other corresponds to mercy, corresponds to a sort of expansiveness of soul. When the Hindus use the term Mahatma, great soul, that's kind of part of the vibe that flows through that. And they're very difficult to communicate at all. And the version of the Kabbalah that I learned in practice, that's as far as you can go as a person. Getting to Chesed, getting those seven aspects of yourself integrated, that's as far as you can get. Above that is the abyss. Above that is a space, is a not space, but is a gap, an existential breach in the fabric of things. And that's the difference between the realms of ultimately created being, which are below the abyss, and the realms of true being, which are above the abyss, which we don't, we can kind of brush against their effects. But those top three ones, Keter, the crown, Chokmah, wisdom, Bina, understanding, you can assign them to the three persons of the Christian Trinity or the three Hindu persons of Trimurti. I'm sure Crowley has, the Thelemites can associate that with something or other. What am I thinking? It'll be Nuit Hadith and Rahur Kuij, probably. There we are. Beyond the human, we're dealing with certain powers that manifest to humanity but are not, that's beyond us.
And then there is beyond us, really, because get to the Ein Sof, the Ein Sof,
then you get to the three veils of negative existence, and spend a while brooding over the thought of negative existence. What does that mean? The idea is that these divine powers, as we can encounter them, are themselves simply a manifestation or an expression or a reflection downward of an ultimate reality that is completely beyond our comprehension, beyond our experience. It's not even something we can begin to touch.
Hmm.
And so very frustrating for the kind of mind that says, no, the universe should be my toy. That kind of mindset doesn't actually work very well in practice.
So, as you said earlier, there's the possibility that you could go from Malkuth to Hod, so 10 to 8. There's a path there. And there's a lot of little paths like this where you go, hang on, there's a path there. What's going on? Because there is this sort of arguably what one might call the common path, which is via them all, the path of the flaming sword, I believe it's called,
yes.
Where you go, 10, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, etc., etc. Yeah. But what do you, and that is, in a way, when you look at that path, it's ultimately balanced because it's sort of, mm-hmm. you're going through each yeah. stage that's needed. However, as mm-hmm. you've said, there is these other, you look at it and go, hang on, I could go, there's a path here.
You can
go,
you can zigzag all over space and time if you want to. And I think many people do. Mm. Most of us have an inherent bias toward either the intellectual or the emotional side. Mm. We have a balance. We have a bias toward form or toward force, and so we're going to tend to be drawn that way or that way. We may wander up this path a little bit and over that one a bit, and so on. And there, but the thing is, it's not just a matter of going, you know, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6 like a rocket countdown. If you actually establish yourself in Hod, let's say, you have to establish yourself by way of both the paths, because you have to integrate Hod with Yesod and with Malkut. So you have to work both of those paths, and of course the path between between Yesod and Malkut. So if you were to go, you know, traipsing up the path from Malkut to Hod over onto the, you know, the side of force, okay, great, you're there. You've gotten this sense of thoughts are things. You've gotten that philosophic inspiration. You sense the way that the world is a creation of thoughts in the minds of God, if you want to call them that. Okay. And how does that relate to you as a living person? Mm. How does that relate to this dimly sensed sort of vibe that you may be getting? Okay. Then you have to start integrating integrating Yesod. And so that way, you're going to have to work two more paths. You're going to have to find a way to relate it to Malkut. You're going to have to find a way to relate it to Hod. Yeah. And by the time you finish that, you've got that nice little triangle, and that becomes a stable basis. Okay. Or let's say you decide to do it the other way around. You pop. You're a very emotional, romantic kind of person, and you know you rise. You climb your way up the path on the other side from Malkut to Netzach, okay? And you come to see the universe as this congeries of forces, as this, you know, basically this immense whirl of forces that is typified by love. Okay, great. That's a very important experience. Now you've got two other aspects of yourself that you're going to have to grapple with sooner or later. There's that realm of life, of the life force, of vibes, and there's this realm of thought. And so there's a whole series of additional paths that you're going to have to work. And you can work them in a straightforward, balanced way. You can work them in an unbalanced way. You can flounder around doing all kinds of things, possibly for multiple lifetimes. You will eventually get it.
Why do you have to be balanced?
Because if you're not, you don't get through the veil.
Why?
I don't know. It just doesn't seem to work. The traditional teaching is that the only way you can go through the veil at first is straight up from Yesod, and you have to have the balancing forces of Hod and Netzach in place to hold you so that you can actually go straight up. Mm. If you don't have Hod and Netzach, it's like, you know, a tightrope walker has to have that stick with weights on the end to hold their balance. But that's a metaphor. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anyone's really sure. There may be a mystic sitting on a mountain somewhere who could give you a nice quick explanation. I can't. But certainly the tradition and also my experience suggests that it's true. You need to have that previous balance between, you know, those three subtler factors. You have to, the life force and thought and feeling, you bring those into balance, you bring those into integration, and then the veil opens. Then the veil trembles and parts in the middle. You start getting these little glimpses and flashes through the veil, and eventually you pass through it.
And all the while, we're going along these paths, 22, mm-hmm. I believe, and mm-hmm. not only do we have 22 paths, we also have a multitude of correspondences. Mm-hmm. Most famously, I would say, you have a number, a Hebrew letter, and mm-hmm. and the name of that letter, so Aleph mm-hmm. or Beth or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then you have a trump from the tarot, and you also have
a zodiac. Yes, and then do we get into fun? Because of course, it's every third tradition has its own set of of correspondences to the paths. Dion Fortune like to say that the spheres are objective, but the paths are subjective, and this, which is kind of a vague way of saying the spheres are basically everyone agrees on what they are. The paths, the symbols that key to the paths seem to vary from tradition to tradition, and not inappropriately so. I've worked with about 5 different sets at this point, and they all work.
Yeah.
The important thing is that you need a set. You need, because there's that symbolic mode of thinking is very important for working the path. You have to be able to think in symbols. You have to be, but the specific symbols you use can vary depending on the details of the tradition you're working with.
Let's take one path and a few. I mean, what would be a path that interests you? And how, and I guess, you know, take a path, and then how do these correspondences sort of help us along that path?
Pick a path, any path. Yes. well, we might as well take the path from Malko Tiesa, the first one that we encounter on the middle pillar, climbing upwards. You know, you've got in the standard Golden Dawn version. Okay, it's the 32nd path. It is associated with the Hebrew letter Tau. It is associated with the Terra Trump of the world. It is associated with the planet Saturn. And if you have a copy of 777 handy, you can end up listing correspondences for a week. And all of that's useful. You know, because it gives you a handle on that. It gives you a set of mnemonic triggers that you can use to kind of focus your consciousness into the state of that path, which eventually develops into a way of moving from Yesod or from Malkut to Yesod and back again. And so that's, you know, that's certainly one of the options.
It's interesting, though, sort of just to add something in there. I mean, it's interesting with regard to those correspondences and those symbols. If you know your symbols, as you said, they're going off the Golden Dawn, the traditional Golden Dawn system. One of the first symbols you're going to meet, which I think it's kind of funny, right, considering the tradition, you're going to meet Saturn straight away, which is everything that comfortable material, especially modern life, doesn't like. Limitation, death, mortality, straight away, first thing, limitation, death, mortality. That's what you have to overcome first, would you say, if you were to look at the, you know, Saturn as that kind of symbol?
Exactly. And, well, also, we hate limitations.
Oh, yeah.
We hate slowness. We hate patience. We want to leap in our cars, if not our you know, our jet cars or what have you, and go zooming off. And Saturn is saying, no, you get to sit here and wait until I'm ready. So yeah, no, it's. I think it was very well chosen for its own time, but again, there are many different traditions there. There's a version of the Tree of Life that was used by William Gray, and also used by R.J. Stewart these days, who was one of his students. That actually the card that goes there is the moon. And so the thing you have to deal with rising up from, there's some real truth in this, rising up from Malkut to Yesod, you're dealing with illusion. You're dealing with the fact you're moving into this sort of the realm of images and illusions and deceptions, a sort of fairy realm in the awkward sense of that word, where you can never be sure what's going on. And of course, that expresses a very real part of that journey. In the system that I learned from John Gilbert, that that path is the path of Trump One, the magician. And as the magician, you know, there, because John always used the Rider-Waite deck. That was his initiatory deck. And so, as you're rising up, as you're rising up from Malkut, your task is to master the four elements on that table. You have to attain that mastery of the elemental world that the magician has. And once you have done that, you achieve Yesod. So to some extent, each of these different ways of looking at the tree enable you to understand the tree in a different way, enable you to understand the journey in a different way. But, you know, they all have something to teach. because there is a very Saturnine quality to that path, and there is a very Moon quality to that path, and there is a very, very much a matter of having to master your own elemental correspondences and the elements in the world in order to make that path. So it's a matter of what you want to emphasize.
What's the most interesting or peculiar alteration you've seen to the Tree of Life?
Oh, that's a tough one. That really is a tough one. Because in terms of peculiar, it would almost certainly be Kenneth Grant's work. And peculiar was his stock in trade.
Oh, absolutely.
And the thing, how to say this? I reread Kenneth Grant not long ago. I had read a bunch of his stuff many years ago, and I reread him not all that long ago after doing all of the work, all the study of H.P. Lovecraft that went into my tentacle novels, and I was left most of the way through this going, my God, the world, he missed out. The world could have had one of the truly great writers of weird fiction. Grant was, his sense of tentacled Lovecraftian horror was brilliant, but he put it into occultism rather than filling the world with eldritch short stories and novels. I'm never really sure how seriously to take him, because Grant always had the vibe to me. Always seemed to have the vibe, a kind of a trickster vibe.
I think it's a lot of occultists have that side to them, right?
Yeah, there's that mercurial quality. But he, more than anyone else, you always wonder, how seriously did he take this? You know, is he pulling your leg? You know, he's saying, you know, that, you know, and we did this really interesting working, and this happened and that happened, and everyone involved had to be carted away to a madhouse afterwards. You know, you're going, okay, is this an advertisement for work? This is not exactly encouraging, but it does make a great story. So he's certainly the most peculiar.
Okay.
But most interesting, that would really puzzle me to try to give any kind of answer to, because it's all interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fascinating. It all has something to teach. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just, you know, the result of, you know, somebody who has a bunch of planets in Gemini or something, but as I do, but, you know, but it's also interesting.
So thus far, it's all been so heavily, you know, it's almost been like a Dion Fortune cosmic doctrine type conversation of this, so symbolic, so heavily symbolic.
Of course.
How do we use this? You know, when we're really speaking practically.
Okay.
What does that look like?
Okay, practical? Well, it doesn't get any less de-unfortunate, because the first set of practice is meditation, discursive meditation, uploading all this stuff into your imagination so you think this way. Because you know, as you were saying, it's a grammar. It's a language. And like every other language, you have to learn it, you have to get fluent in it, you have to get to the degree of fluency where you don't have to make an effort. Where you just can automatically talk in it. And a lot of the basic practices of occultistic magic focus on getting to that point of fluency, that point where, you know, you see something red and you automatically think of Gibora. Okay. And because once you've done that, then you have a key that you can use to work with symbolic experience. You'll find that it starts showing up in your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And very much in the kind of active imagination / path working / scrying that a lot of people in this path do. So there's that. And then, of course, once you have a detailed alphabet of symbols, you can use that for a wide range of purposes, for example, practical magic. If you have really built these concepts into your mind, you have them as mnemonic triggers, you have all of these things going on for, let's say, we were talking about Gibora, okay, you want that energy of will. And let's say you're in a situation where you really need that strength of will, okay? So you have the color red, and you have the number 5, and you have all these other things that kind of key into it. You include that in a ritual, whether a complex, you know, ceremonial magic ritual or just a matter of wearing a red shirt and putting, you know, 5 pennies into your pocket. as little five little pieces of, you know, pieces of steel, five steel washers in your pocket or something. And all of a sudden you tune into that state of will, of focused intention, and of don't mess with me, I will steamroller you. It works. It works extremely well. And so you have these practical applications in, and that's the mnemonic side of things, that's the pragmatic side of things, but you were asking for practical stuff.
Yeah.
There's also the extent to which, as you practice with this stuff, as you use these symbols to attune yourselves to the symbols of these states of consciousness, the states of consciousness begin revealing themselves to you. You can start keying into that Yesod consciousness, that Hod consciousness, that Netzach consciousness, when it's useful to you. And as of course, every one of them is extremely useful in its proper place. And so, you know, those aspects of yourself become more richly developed. They become more flexible, more powerful. You become more of a complete person. And then, you know, as you get to the point of starting to work with the spheres above the veil, and you're starting to get into the Tiferes consciousness, the Geburah consciousness, the Chesed consciousness, then you start being able to do things that most people can't. Mm-hmm. And that's repeated practice of symbolic experience, whether you're doing it with meditation, whether you're doing it with active imagination, whether you're doing it with ritual or any of the various other means, it has that effect. You begin to become the kind of person who can do the improbable things that are out of reach for many, many people.
I'm not sure entirely how to phrase this, but mm-hmm. where do you think people go wrong with the Tree of Life? And that's what I mean about not being able to, because, you know, to say, oh, you're doing it incorrectly, I don't really want to say that, but mm-hmm. you know, what's something you think people maybe misunderstand or
don't? Yeah. There is always the tendency, and well, I'm going to preface this by saying that all of these misunderstandings are, they're ultimately transitory. If you keep on working with it, it will clear up eventually. It is kind of self-correcting, but it can take a good long time. The first risk, the first major problem is identifying yourself with the spheres. You know, getting the classic example is the solar identification. People doing intense Tifereth rituals, and you're trying to get that solar consciousness. And if you've ever met a really out of control, badly dignified Leo, somebody who is just a complete blazing jerk, because they're constantly, you know, gazing at the glory of their own self-image. I have some Leo in my chart, so I know this state rather well. That's what you can get by doing all this intensive solar work. That's why the Golden Dawn blew itself sky high. It's, you know, the Golden Dawn rituals, they're beautiful, they're powerful, but the Adeptus Minor is excessively solar, and they were putting a lot of people into that who probably shouldn't have gotten it. And so you had all these people who their egos inflated, as of course Aleister Crowley's did, to monumental scale, and boom, away it went. This has happened at a lot of magical orders. They get this idea that, you know, the Tifereth, the solar consciousness, that's the next great step, and they don't realize that you have to grow into that. You can't just grab it, because if you grab it, you're grabbing it in its reflected form below the veil. You're grabbing it in the form of a wildly overinflated ego. And that becomes problematic. Less common, but even more destructive, you get the people who managed to get, who went, go and grab Geburah or go and grab Chesed. And there you get, you know, the these zealots who want to destroy everything that they don't see as pure. Mm-hmm. Or you get the cult leaders. Mm-hmm. For whom, you know, everybody else should be absorbed into them, basically, and there, I'll think for you. And it's very destructive. So these are some of the problems. Those are correct. Those are self-correcting, but they're self-correcting by way of karma, and it's not pretty. Mm-hmm. So the first, and I think the crucial thing here, is don't claim a state of initiation that you have not reached, and better yet, just don't claim it at all. In the Chinese martial arts, there's this great custom. There's a title, Sifu, mm-hmm. which is the title used by a teacher of Chinese martial arts, but it's never a title you give yourself.
Yeah.
If you say, I am Sifu so-and-so, everybody in traditional arts knows that you're a jerk. Uh-huh. And knows that you don't know enough. You literally don't know enough about the subject to be worth bothering with. It's other people who call you Sifu.
Mm-hmm.
And as other people call you Sifu, and there's a lot of back and forth, and you know, even somebody who isn't necessarily that good may have a few people who say, yeah, he's my Sifu. But you know, the gradually, you know, within the community, you get this real sense saying, yeah, Mr. Yang, he's Sifu Yang, he's worth it while. And so there's that definite sense of validation by something other than your own ego. In the sort of, well, mutated descendant of the Golden Dawn that I inherited from John Gilbert and have passed on more recently, the Fellowship of the Hermetic Rose. The idea is that there are seven degrees of initiation, but nobody has the seventh. Okay, uh-huh. The seventh is purely internal. The degree of adept. Nobody, if you claim it, everybody in the tradition knows you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know enough about the tradition to bother with, and you're a jerk.
It's the ultimate ego. The final ego check, right?
Exactly. It's one of a number of carefully placed ego checks. But I ripped that off from the Chinese tradition, and you know, and I freely admit. But just it's a way to keep people aware of the fact that there's always further to go. There's always more to learn, and the whole point of this is not to get a title, not to get the grand exalted panjandrum degree, which makes you better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. It's simply, you know, you've learned some things and you've done some initiatory ritual, and now the real work begins. Have fun.
Hmm. Is there anything key you'd like to add about the Tree of Life or the Kabbalah?
It's an extremely flexible and functional system. There's a reason why it is hardwired into the structure of Western esoteric spirituality. The book that we didn't really get around to talking about, John Gilbert's book, The Tree of Spirit, which I edited for Eon Books a little while ago, is a fairly good introduction to John's own idiosyncratic Tree of Life. I'm actually working on a book on the subject now, on the Tree of Life, on the Kabbalah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of odd because my first ever published book, Paths of Wisdom, was on the Tree of Life. It was on the Kabbalah, and it was very, very standard Orthodox Golden Dawn because that's what I practiced in those days. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I've learned a few things since then, so I'm kind of giving, this is my current version. This is what I am now doing, and very heavily influenced by, of course, everything I studied from John Gilbert. And it's been very interesting to go back, but one of the things that has definitely happened is that I've had that experience of going, wow, yes, there's a very good reason why this is as important as it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've also got quite a few other books, right, on the Kabbalah?
Well, actually, I haven't done that many.
Oh,
Paths of Wisdom. No, Paths of Wisdom is my basic Kabbalah book. Learning Ritual Magic covers the basics. Of course, that's not just mine. There were three of us who wrote that, one of whom has now passed. The quote, Claire Vaughan, unquote, was my wife Sarah's, that was her pen name. Mm-hmm. And she wrote two books and a number of articles under that. And then let's see, obviously there's a little bit on that in Circles of Power, and there are little dribs and drabs of it in a couple of other books, but no, I actually haven't written. Oh, that's right. The other one, of course, is The Celtic Golden Dawn, which gives a version of the Tree of Life reworked to fit the symbolism of the Druid revival. And if that sounds weird to you, well, it is weird, but you know, but it works. And there are people who are enthusiastically practicing it right now.
What's out of interest? What is Tipperath in that?
Well, okay. This is Druidry, meaning that there's no one version. In the specific set of Welsh and Brythonic derived deities that I use just as an example, that would be Hissus, the chief of tree spirits, the oak god, who is kind of in Druid revival literature, is kind of the messenger. Mm-hmm. Is the, you know, the, but the, but the, it's complicated. But yeah, Jesus is the Tiferet deity. But yeah.
Okay. What are you working on now?
Well, there's that Kabbalah book that I just talked about.
Yeah.
Other than that, I am hard at work on finishing a book on mundane astrology, the astrology of politics and economics. And that should be done within a matter of days, and I will be sending that on its way to its publisher. And let's see. Other than that, got some fiction underway. I have another book in the Ariel Moravec occult detective series. Yet more significant occult instruction expressed in the form of detective adventure.
Mm-hmm. All right. And if people are interested in your astrology, you also have Patreon, don't you, right? For your
Patreon and Subscribestar. I do mundane astrology there. I do ingresses for the solstices and the equinoxes. I do eclipse charts, and I do some other charts as well. And if you look up my name, John Michael Greer, you will find me.
Well, I will put the links for the Gilbert book, the Patreon, in the description below, alongside the other books we mentioned.
Thank you.
I feel that's a good place to finish up. So, John Michael Greer, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.